where the city of Rochelle spread out below.
It wouldn't be this far out, would it?
Hadrian shrugged. We're coming into a forest now.
He nodded at the staggered line of pine and spruce that grew just up the slope. The trees were gathered in small groups as if chatting about their neighbors, but farther on, they marshaled en masse, forming a dense forest that covered the base of a coastal mountain.
Was there a forest on the map?
Do you remember?
Royce shook his head.
No, but these trees are, what,
30, 40 years old?
Probably been cut for firewood for generations.
That map goes back hundreds of years.
No telling what this place might have looked like then.
The only positive thing is that it does make sense for Vilar to be out here. The seclusion is ideal. I can't imagine too many people coming up this way if they didn't have to.
Hadrian took advantage of Royce's pause and plopped down in the grass.
At least the puddles left by the previous days of rain were cool.
He scooped up a handful and wetted the back of his neck. Then he lay back and stared up at the blue sky and white clouds.
Beautiful day. Doesn't seem right.
What doesn't?
Royce asked, scanning the way ahead and not looking pleased.
That such awful things should happen on such nice days.
You'd rather be up here in the rain?
I was thinking more about the people down there.
You saw them this morning, all dressed up in their finest clothes.
Been a long, dark winter. They just want a little happiness.
And on the first good day in months, what happens?
It's not fair.
Royce gave Hadrian a puzzled look.
That's so odd.
What? Here we are, fighting brambles and slick, muddy slopes, while trying to find a madman before he massacres hundreds. And your thoughts are focused on how unfair it is for the people having a grand time at a festival.
Why is that odd?
Why wouldn't you think of us struggling in this heat against these thorny vines, while breathing in these tiny black flies?
Isn't that unfair?
Why can't we be eating pork and dancing with ladies on such a fine day?
Hadrian chuckled.
What? Why is that funny?
It isn't. It's just, I have this image in my head of you dancing. Can't get past it.
Royce frowned. I'm just saying it's strange that you feel sorry for them rather than us.
Well, I do feel sorry for you, if that makes it better.
Royce clapped his hands together before his face, trying to kill some of the swarm that plagued him.
Why?
Because you can't understand why it is I would feel sorry for them. Makes me think your world is very small.
Oh, Royce said, sounding disappointed.
I thought you were going to say something else.
Really?
What?
Royce made a sound, spitting as if the flies had invaded his mouth.
He stepped back from the brambles, waving his hands before his face as he retreated.
Miserable little horrors. Why do they do that? Fly right into our mouth, eyes and nose. It makes no sense. They can't like it. I certainly don't. There's no benefit to be had, and yet into my mouth they go.
What was it you thought I was going to say?
Oh.
Royce washed a hand over his face.
I thought you might be on the verge of apologizing for volunteering to be a martyr last night.
Apologize? Are you kidding? I saved us.
Is that how you see it?
Is there another way?
You put me in a very unpleasant position.
Hadrian sat up to face him.
Oh, I'm sorry. Were you the one tied up all night while a dwarf played with a knife, reminding you about his intention to slit your throat? 'Cause I thought that was me.
Royce was struggling, trying to extract something from his tongue with two fingers. A fly, no doubt. He got something, peered at it in disgust, and gave it a flick.
You're supposed to be learning from me. You can't do that if you don't listen.
Learn from you, Hadrian said.
I think you've got that backward, pal. Arcadius teamed us up so I could teach you.
Royce, who had moved on to cleaning his eyes, paused.
Did you just call me pal?
Yeah. It means friend. Literally, brother.
I know what it means.
So it's just your hearing that's going. If you want to talk about odd, that would certainly qualify. You have the most disturbingly acute ears of anyone I've ever met. Seriously,
I don't know how you sleep at night. The crickets must drive you insane.
It's not the crickets. It's definitely not the crickets.
Hadrian smirked. I would think that this job would have convinced you of the virtues of being a decent human being. Look at Roland. My friendship with him has helped us. Not just once, but twice. Being respectful to Evelyn has reaped huge rewards. And we lived last night because, a long time ago, I acted honorably.
Was that the same night you helped slaughter a town? Royce asked. And it wasn't that long ago, was it? You're not that old.
Because of nights like that, I feel old.
So, which was it?
Royce asked. Were you saved because of a kindness extended to a girl? Or were you in jeopardy in the first place because you and your compatriots killed most, but not all, of the people during that battle?
It's because I protected Seton.
Are you sure? What would you have protected her from if the town hadn't been sacked? And if you hadn't been so proficient with your sword, the other soldiers might not have granted her to you. Which makes me wonder. What actually made the difference? Your kindness or your cruelty?
Why is it you choose to see the darkness in everything? Because it's there, and ignoring that fact invites peril.
But light is also there, and recognizing it allows happiness.
What good is being happy if you're dead?
What good is being alive if you're miserable?
Royce paused, and for a moment Hadrian was certain he had won.
Royce was stumped, but then he tilted his head.
What's up, boy? Hadrian asked. You hear something?
Wasn't funny the first time, Royce said. A moment later, a woman's scream came from up the hill.
I'm not just going to kill her.
Villar realized this with the perfect clarity that accompanied every mistake he had made while the noble cow hid to the side of the door. She had plotted to lock him in. He imagined her literally as a bovine with black and white spots. In his mind's eye, he saw her standing on her back legs, a massive tongue licking the broad pink nostrils of her nose, waiting with hooves up and together like a begging dog, hoping he would fall for the bait. The moment he opened the door, the second he rushed in so blindly, focused on her decoy of blankets and straw, was the same second she slipped out. He almost fell for it. The hair and the chain. His mind had registered those two things as incontrovertible evidence that she lay on the floor near the back wall. How could he conclude anything else? If her neck wore a collar attached to a chain secured to a wall, the odds were strong the rest of her was there as well. His eyes and his mind had joined together in a conspiracy to betray him. If the room was bigger, or the cow smaller, the ruse might have worked. The realization of how close he'd come to a fatal mistake was frightening. As she lay on the floor screaming, Villar felt his heart pound from the near miss. He took a second to breathe, to calm down. Then he adjusted the grip on his knife. She scuttled away, kicking out with her legs like a crab. When she rolled to her knees and started to stand, he grabbed her. The Duchess was no dainty woman, no slender flower. She equaled his height and outweighed him by 20 pounds. With a sharp lurch, she slammed her body against his, knocking him back against the wall, nearly throwing him to the floor. The assault also knocked the Duchess off balance, and she went down to one knee. He was after her an instant later, but the old cow threw everything she could find at him, including two of the heavy urns. One hit his hand, knocking the knife free. He grabbed it up just in time to see the Duchess making for the door. He was on her then, catching her in the middle of the room. One hand latched onto her butchered hair, pulling her head back, while the other brought up the knife. She continued to twist and kick until the knife reached her neck.
Stop!
Villar looked up as the two foreigners burst into the temple. The smaller one had that white knife, the one that had stabbed the golem and somehow cut his chest. The other, the big one Seton had called the Razor, held two blades, one in each hand.
Kill her, and you die, Royce shouted.
A portly woman, whom Hadrian assumed to be the Duchess of Rochelle, was on her knees, panting, sweating, her head pulled back.
Villars stood behind her, his left hand holding a fist of the woman's hair, his right holding a dagger near her throat.
"Help me!" Jenny Winter cried.
Irritated by the outburst, Villars pulled her head further back, causing the Duchess to cry out once more.
"Drop your weapons," Villars said.
Royce made a sound like he was clearing his nose.
"Why? Do it, or I'll kill her."
Royce glanced at Hadrian.
"Didn't I already explain that if he kills her, I'll kill him?"
"You did. So, what is this idiot doing? Threatening us with suicide?" Royce asked. "He's under the impression you care about her life."
"Really?"
Royce chuckled. "It's an easy mistake. You did order him not to kill her, and, besides, he doesn't know you."
"Okay, sure. But even if I was someone else, I mean, why would anyone surrender? Would you?"
"Even if that person cared if she lives, Villar is still at a disadvantage. It's like trading pieces in chess. Sure, he would lose her, but then he loses the entire game. On the other hand, if we surrender, he'll kill all of us, and we get nothing. No one would take that deal. It's stupid. Not to mention, I'm going to get paid, whether she's dead or not."
Hadrian focused on Villar.
"That's his way of saying, we aren't going to put our weapons down. But if you kill her, well, I'm sure you got the rest."
Villar hesitated, the knife unsteady at the woman's throat.
"You need to make a deal, boys,"
Jenny said, her voice steady.
"Villar made you an offer, so now you counter. That's how haggling works. So, now it's your turn. What do you propose?"
Royce shook his head.
"Don't have to counter."
"Yes, you do," the Duchess cried. "You want me to live, or we wouldn't be having this conversation, right?" "Of course, right. But we're at an impasse, so you need to deal. Got it?"
"Whose side are you on?" Royce asked.
Her eyes widened in surprise.
"My own, obviously. I want to live. Now listen."
She allowed herself to swallow. In the small room it made a sound they all heard.
"I don't want to die. But that's beside the point, because, bizarrely, this has nothing to do with me. It's between the three of you. You don't want him to kill me, and Villar doesn't want you to kill him. That's good, because you both have something the other wants. Everyone can win here, even me."
No one said anything, as all three waited.
"Okay, good. How about this? Villar lets me go, and you let him go. How does that sound?"
Royce smiled.
"Fine with me. Go ahead. Let her go."
"There. You see?" Jenny said.
Villar shook his head.
"You think I'm an idiot? The moment I let you go, they'll rush me. This won't work. It's stupid. We can't make a deal. And if I'm going to die, then I'm taking..."
"It's not stupid,"
Jenny shouted as the blade pressed against her skin.
"I can make any deal work. It's what I do. Now shut up and listen to me."
"I'm not letting you go so long as they can chase after me the moment I do."
"Fine, fine, no problem. This will be easy."
"It will?"
Hadrian asked.
"Absolutely,"
the Duchess replied.
"Villar, how would it be if these nice gentlemen and I got into the cell and you locked us in? That way, you're free, and no one can harm you."
"What's to stop him from..." Royce started.
"Shut up!" Jenny shouted. "Whoever you are, please, just be quiet."
"His name's Royce, and I'm Hadrian Blackwater."
"How nice. Now, Royce, Hadrian, please shut up and let me handle this, will you?"
She forced a smile.
"The two of you will keep your weapons. That way, you won't be at Villar's mercy. Locked in a room, sure, but safely locked in a room."
"That's not very..." Royce began.
"Shush! I don't want to hear arguments or counter-proposals. We have a deal on the table. Will you agree?"
Royce looked at the door. puffed, then said, "Fine."
"Hadrian?"
"Yeah, sure. Why not?"
"Vilar, you want to live, and so do I. This is a fair trade, a better than equitable exchange. My life for yours. Will you take it?"
Vilar didn't reply.
"Lower the knife, and let me move back while these two enter the cell. Then I'll get in. You can lock the door and just walk out."
He still didn't answer, but slowly the knife moved away from Jenny's throat. She waved for Royce and Hadrian to enter the cell.
"Gentlemen, if you please."
Royce looked disgusted but stepped in. Hadrian went so far as to sheathe his swords before entering. Then Jenny Winter followed the two of them. Vilar shoved her forward into the room, slammed the door shut, and turned the key that he'd left in the lock. The moment the door sealed, Jenny threw her arms around Hadrian and kissed him.
"I love you!"
After the embrace, she started toward Royce, whose dagger was still out. Hadrian pulled her back.
"I wouldn't do that if I were you. Royce isn't much of a hugger." "Well, gentlemen, you have my eternal gratitude. But who in Maribor's name are you? And what are you doing here?"
"Your father sent us to rescue you," Hadrian said. "He hired us to discover what happens to you," Royce corrected as he moved to the door.
He knelt before the latch. "And you did both. You're my heroes. I'll knight you or make you earls or something."
Hadrian smiled at her.
"I think only kings can do that."
"Kings?" the woman burst out. "Leo, I need to find my husband. I need to show the bishop I'm still alive so Leo can be crowned king."
"Should have thought of that before locking us in a stone room," Hadrian said.
"I did," Jenny replied.
She pointed at Royce, who had just managed to pop the lock and open the door. Royce immediately raced out like a dog released from a cage after being teased by an arrogant squirrel.
"You knew he could pick locks?" Hadrian asked the Duchess. "I knew he wasn't the type to allow himself to be confined in a cell unless he was positive he could get out. Business is like a card game. You have to judge people quickly and play the odds."
Hadrian looked out the open door. Royce was already so far away they could no longer hear him. At that moment, the only sound came from the breeze and birds.
"Look, I have to help Royce find Vilar," Hadrian said. "You need to stay here. Safest place, really. I know you want to go down to the feast, but right now that's not such a good idea. We'll be back after we find Vilar. Then we'll escort you back to town."
"And if you don't return, shall I stay here and starve, or should I wander through the wilderness until I die of exposure?"
"Look, we will be back, I promise. But if it makes you feel better, town is straight that way."
He pointed at the door. "Just keep heading down the hill, and you'll run right into Rochelle.
Just don't go until we get back."
"Why not?"
"It could be dangerous."
The Duchess scoffed.
"I'm not some fragile debutante. I'm sure I can manage a hike downhill to town."
Hadrian glanced outside.
"I'm never going to catch up with Royce now. I didn't even see which way he went."
"Look, I'm wasting valuable time. You just have to trust me on this. If we can't find Vilar, if he gets away, there's a chance he might create a monster and attack the feast."
Jenny Winter blinked. Hadrian saw the confusion on her face.
"It's called a golem, a monster made of stone."
The explanation sounded absurd even to him.
"Vilar made one before. If he does it again, he'll slaughter everyone at the feast. So you don't want to go there, understand?"
Her hand went to her mouth.
"Leo,"
she whispered, and her eyes darted toward the door.
"Look, I know you're worried, but there's nothing you can do. Truly, you need to stay here. Don't leave. Keep yourself safe."
With that, he ran out in pursuit of Vilar and Royce. Chapter 27. The Spring Feast. Jenny had never been in the best of shape, and being trapped for over 2 weeks in a small cell, eating next to nothing, had only made matters worse. The moment Hadrian left, she bolted toward the city and was soon sweating rivers and heaving for breath. Blood pounded in her head, her chest burned, and she'd only run 50 feet. 3 times she stumbled. 2 times she nearly fell.
Run, feet! Run!
Her whole focus was on the ground before her.
Don't fall! Don't fall! Don't fall! Rock! Don't fall! Don't fall! Tree!
On and on she went, only vaguely registering the blur of green and brown and the warmth of a hot sun baking her skin, something she hadn't felt in days. The heat was nice, but it made her perspire. By the time she hit pavement, she was soaked, struggling to see through sweat-filled eyes. She had come down out of the trees and fields and entered the broken ruins of the rookery. She'd seen the place before, but only from the window of a carriage, and only the part of the destitute neighborhood that bordered Little Gurham near the harbor. When she emerged from the forest, she was in the shattered heart of this neglected corner of the realm. Grass grew up through the cobblestones and the entrances to buildings. Last year's leaves remained in corners where the wind had gathered them. The old buildings with their empty windows and missing doors looked hollow, cadaverous. Some were missing walls. Rotting ploughs and rims of broken wheels rusted on the street or in the yards. Despite the neglect, Jenny spotted yellow and purple wildflowers sprouting everywhere, even on the roofs of some buildings. She loved flowers, and seeing them again made her smile to the point of crying.
I'm alive!
Jenny found she couldn't get enough air, as if the world were suddenly in short supply, and her chest burned from the effort of trying. Blood flushed her face. She could feel it hot and full, and her heart continued to pound a loud beat.
When did running become so difficult?
When she was younger, and a whole lot thinner, she used to run everywhere. Never once had her head felt like a cork in a shaken bottle of sparkling wine.
When did that change?
The answer came quickly, and in the form of another question.
When was the last time I ran? When I was a child. When I was thin. Now I'm... Little wonder Leo doesn't love me. No one could possibly love this.
Tears added to her torment. She ought to hate Leo, but at that moment what she wanted most was to see his face and know he was safe. All she could remember were the laughs they shared. He was so comfortable to be with, never making her feel ugly or awkward, never hurting or belittling her. Even Jenny's father had a tendency to condescend, to trivialize her feelings. Leo actually listened, or did a damn fine impression of it. He never told her no, never tried to rein her in, or told her to behave. Thinking about it, she wondered if his refusal to protect her from ridicule was less evidence that he didn't care, and more a sign of respect that she could handle herself. And they agreed on so much. At times it felt as if they were the same person. Jenny slowed down. She was out of the rookery, somewhere between Littleton and Little Gurham. This was the trade and business district, filled with warehouses and workshops, and strangely few people.
Everyone is at the festival.
Leo was most certainly there, seated as close as possible to the bishop, trying to impress Tynewell and sway his favor.
If I'm not there, will he be disqualified? Will someone else be chosen? For Maribor's sake, how pathetic am I being? What does it matter who wears the crown? I nearly died, but I'm still alive. I'm free. I'm married to a goddamn duke and I live in a lavish estate. What's there to complain about? So what if he doesn't love me? Who cares? I love him, and I'll keep on loving him.
Bishop Oswald Tynewell stood behind the many panes of glass that formed the great rose window directly above the front doors of Grom Gallimus. 8 stories up, he had a perfect, unobstructed view of the plaza below, The dancing had stopped, and the rope dividers had been removed. Everyone advanced to take their seats at one of 20 tables set up in four rows circling the statue of Novron. Oswald marveled at the accuracy with which they were placed. No one down there could see the spacing the way he could. The fourth row, on the right side, was off a little, and it irked him for no reason he could fathom. The banquet tables appeared tiny from his vantage point, though he knew each seated 12, and that meant more than 200 nobles were gathered. From where Oswald stood, they appeared as little colourful dots, bright blue specks. The rest of the city's citizenry, as well as the throngs of visitors, were forced to stay back behind rope barriers that outlined the plaza. Those who, until recently, had been dancing and singing on the paving stones before the cathedral became sweaty spectators of the momentous event that they expected to reveal itself soon.
"The event will certainly be momentous, and absolutely worth witnessing. Just not too closely."
Not everyone was there. Some of the lesser nobles, such as those who had resigned themselves to monasteries, hadn't come. Also absent were women who were old and unmarried. Inviting them would have appeared strange, if not openly suspicious. Monks and spinsters were nothing for Oswald to be concerned about. None of them could be considered serious contenders for the throne. Oswald's immediate concern centered on the fact that food was being brought out, yet nothing had happened. If the servants pulled the lids off the plates, if they began serving without his presence, there would be concern. Already heads were repeatedly turning to look at the door of Gromgallimus. Everyone was waiting for his entrance, waiting for him to give his speech and explain who the new king of Alban would be. Or at least, how the person would be chosen. Oswald had no intention of coming out. The church was one of the few safe places in the city. At least, that was what Villar had told him, and he ought to know. That mere was doubling in powers best left untapped, but if doing so got the job done, who was he to argue with results? Still, magic could be unpredictable, and Steinwell didn't want to leave his survival in the hands of those who might not be able to control the evil they were planning to unleash. While the Novronian Empire had once employed wizards, magic had also been the source of its destruction. As such, after the fall of the great capital city, magic had been eradicated from the world by edict of the church. Only the truly evil practiced the forbidden art. Its use was grounds for both excommunication and execution. That Villar planned to employ the dark art was further evidence of his vile character. Oswald shivered at the thought of his association with the Mir. And yet, what else could he do? To obtain what he wanted, some rules needed to be bent and some lines needed to be crossed. Oswald felt that so long as he closed his eyes beforehand, he could step over those lines and still absolve himself of guilt by way of ignorance. Besides, no one could tell him that the sinking of the Eternal Empire was virtuous. Sin was often the bridge to salvation. Time kept ticking, and still nothing happened. No revolt, no attack from magical creatures. Oswald pondered what excuse he would give when at last he was forced to emerge. Perhaps he could put them off, saying he still hadn't decided. No, that wouldn't work. The kingdom had already gone 5 months without a king. A contest. He would have to go with that. But what sort? One that was impossible to achieve might be good. It would buy him time to... From outside the window, and through the many panes of glass came the sounds of shouts. At first, they were merely cries of surprise. Then they turned to exclamations of fear. In the plaza below, faces looked up and fingers pointed at the great marble statue of Novron that graced the center of the square. Some 17 feet tall, the sculpture was a marvel of artistry, a source of inspiration, and a point of reverence. But never before had it elicited cries of fear. Oswald couldn't understand the source of the panic until he realized that Novron, who for generations had looked across the plaza to the cathedral, was now looking down at his feet. A moment later, the statue shifted, twisting its torso and drawing forth its sword. A miracle! Oswald stared in stunned wonder. The god Novron has come to life! Many of the nobles believed similarly as they remained in the square, moving away but not fleeing. A few even went so far as to approach the giant figure. Floret Killian, for instance, who was dressed in his long velvet gown of solid blue with a matching cape, was the first to advance. The attire was so inappropriate for the weather, but so apropos for a man to be crowned in. Perhaps Floret saw this animated statue of Novron as a machination of the church. Maybe he thought it was the test their bishop had arranged to find Alban's next king. Fleeing from it might prove a lack of faith. Surely the bishop knew Novron would attend in person, and he would be the one to anoint the next ruler. Why else would the bishop insist that all nobles in the kingdom be present? Why else would he wait so long to declare the identity of the new ruler? Yes, of course. Maribor had told the bishop that his son would make an appearance at the spring festival, and he wanted to ensure that everyone would be on hand to view this miracle. Then the marble Novron began killing people. One of Novron's giant sandals came down on Floret's side and crushed him against the paving stones. From that point on, the statue left red prints wherever that foot landed. With the other leg, Novron kicked Killian's two sons across the plaza. Oswald was certain from the stain on the marble shin that they had died the moment the leg hit them. This was merely the preamble. Once Novron was off his pedestal and had his feet firmly planted, he began swinging the sword. A good 8 feet in length, the huge marble weapon hewed through swaths of people, all conveniently clumped together. With each successive stroke, the once immaculate statue turned scarlet from the spray and splash of blood. Oswald clutched his throat in horror. He stood transfixed by the speed of the massacre. He was appalled that a Mir had chosen to defile the most sacred symbol of the church as his instrument of murder, caused him to hit the panes of the rose window with his fists. How dare he! His horror at the shrieks of the dying and the soon-to-die was overpowered by outrage at the humiliation being wrought upon the faith by a Mir using the image of Novron as a tool of destruction. This is intolerable! Revolution was one thing, dark magic another. But this was an inconceivable perversion. He had to do something. He jogged to the stairs and raced down. Tynwell had no thought as to what he would do when he got to the bottom, but his indignation was overwhelming. He tripped on his own robes and fell the last 3 steps, but he refused to feel the pain. Grabbing up a wrought iron candlestick, he ran from his office to the massive front doors. There he stood, puffing from exertion, leaning on the iron stand and staring around at the empty cathedral. While outside, the screams continued. He didn't dare open the doors. Instead, he peered out through the windows at the massive, animated statue wreaking havoc on the plaza. And just when the bishop felt it couldn't be worse, another towering statue arrived. Villar didn't notice the arrival of Glenmorgan, which was odd, given that the one-time ruler of the Stuart's empire stood a good 12 feet tall, and his boots crushed cobblestone to gravel. Villar was preoccupied, giddy, by his delight in crushing the life out of Alburn's rulers using their own god. The statue of Novron was huge, and so different from the smaller gargoyles he had been used to. It moved slowly, reacting on a delay, but it was powerful beyond belief. And he liked the view. The statue was so tall he could see everything. Everything, except Glenmorgan. That revelation reached him in the form of a tackling blow. Vilar wasn't actually in the plaza. He was remotely operating the golem just as he had done with gargoyles so many times before. And while both Novron the Great and the statue of Glenmorgan, who normally stood on a pedestal in the center of the Imperial Gallery, slammed into a stone pylon that commemorated the war heroes of the First Battle of Ilan Hills, Vilar didn't feel a thing. He also didn't feel the repeated blows Glenmorgan hammered him with. He did, however, see the chips of marble broken from his chest by Glenmorgan's fists.
Griswold!
With Erasmus Nim dead, only the dwarf had the knowledge and ingredients to raise another golem.
He's trying to stop me.
Vilar rolled away, pushing back to his stony feet. Glenmorgan refused to let up and grabbed him from behind. Leaping on Novron's back, he threw an arm around the Emperor's neck and squeezed. Griswold might be a dwarf, a member of the race who had unlocked the secrets of the golem, but he lacked experience at running one. They had let Vilar do all the work, all the prior murders in stone form. They had been lazy, and now the dwarf would pay the price. Griswold fought like a person. An easy mistake. Vilar had done the same his first few times, only neither one was flesh, and stone doesn't breathe. Choking was pointless. Crushing and falling, on the other hand, was devastating. Before she arrived, Jenny was met by a stampede. Hundreds of gaily dressed people fled from the plaza. Ladies in spring gowns and men in hose and buckles ran as if Uberlin were in pursuit. A woman in a light blue dress with white lace cuffs waved harshly at her.
"Run!" she cried. "Novron is killing everyone!"
She might as well have said Grum Gallimus was dancing a jig, for all the sense that made, and Jenny didn't even slow down. Not that she was moving all that fast. Her one bit of luck was that everywhere she had run that day had been downhill.
"No, no, go back!"
A man holding a fanciful hat in his hands waved at her.
"Everyone has been killed down there!"
Jenny did slow down then. The man's words hadn't retarded her speed, but the smear of blood across the side of his face gave her pause. That streak of gore made her take his warning seriously. And yet it still didn't stop her. She continued down Center Street, to where it joined Vintage Avenue. From there, she had an unobstructed view of the plaza. Two giant stone statues were locked in battle, one on the other's back with an arm around its neck. Below them was a horrific display of colors. Like blueberries and strawberry jam, bodies lay on the blood-soaked paving stones of the plaza. Jenny continued moving forward.
"Leo?"
She scanned the bodies. They were a ghastly mess, and she didn't think she would be able to identify him in that tumbled, macabre mass. But she thought she might spot the vest. It was so bright. Then Jenny remembered she hadn't bought it. But even if she had, she wouldn't have had the chance to give it to him. They took her before she returned home.
"I wish I had given you something,"
she cried once more. If any doubt hid within the shadows of her heart that she still loved Leo Hargrave, it was washed away by those tears.
"Even if Leo doesn't love me, he's a good man, kind man. I couldn't love anyone this much if that wasn't true."
Something blue moved. A man near the edge of the plaza struggled to crawl. One of his legs was twisted unnaturally, and he hauled himself away by the strength of his arms, leaving a trail of red in his wake. Overhead, The giants staggered, their massive stone legs bashing the paving stone so hard they shook the Spring Day decorations off the walls. The statue of Novron was struggling to throw off the statue of Glenmorgan, and in the effort, 4 feet repeatedly bombarded the plaza, threatening to crush the desperate man. Jenny's heart leapt at the possibility that it might be Leo, and she rushed forward into the red sea beneath the stone-footed hailstorm. She quickly realized it wasn't him. This man was younger, thinner. She didn't stop. Even if it wasn't Leo, it could have been, and she wanted to help him just as she hoped someone was helping the man she loved. Without even looking at the statues, and gasping for every ounce of air she could haul into her chest, Jenny grabbed hold of the man by the shoulders of his tunic and pulled. In her younger days, the Duchess of Rochelle had hauled, rolled, and stacked casks of whiskey along with the men. The cripple on the plaza was lighter than any cask she had ever hauled. She dragged him away from the carnage with speed, if not gentleness. Jenny wasn't certain where this extra burst of energy came from. It didn't matter. She had it, and was going to make use of the newfound strength. She pulled the survivor out of harm's way. Then the ground shook, and there was a great crack. Novron had managed to lift Glenmorgan, flip him over his shoulder, and slam him down hard on the plaza's pavers. While the Emperor God had been chiseled from solid marble, Glenmorgan had been sculpted from lesser stone. The huge ruler of the Stuart Empire, who had once stood in the center of the Imperial Gallery, broke. Just to be certain, Novron brought his foot down and shattered his adversary, scattering the pieces across the plaza. Jenny had dragged the wounded man a short way up Vintage Avenue, but it wasn't far enough. The giant marble monster was finishing off the wounded, crushing them under his massive feet. He would notice them before long. The wounded man knew it too, and she felt him cringe. Vintage Avenue was one of the finer streets in the city, and equipped with storm drains. The large pipes ran under the street and flushed rainwater to the nearby river. The mouths were as big as barrels. A normal-sized man could wriggle in and disappear. "Crawl into that drain. Get as deep as possible without falling in," she told him. "I'll be right behind." She heard the slam of stone on stone. Looking back at the square, she realized the golem had spotted them. The giant statue began its uphill charge. "Damn!" she cursed. They couldn't both shimmy into that drainpipe in time. "Tell Leo I love him," she said, and ran away from the wounded man. As she did, Jenny flailed her arms and shouted, "Vilar, you son of a Horus weirbat! I'm still alive, and you're still ugly!" She wasn't committing suicide, although she realized it might have looked like it. To the wounded noble, she probably appeared to be sacrificing herself to save him. In reality, she had a plan. Her strategy was to catch Vilar's attention and lure the golem away, granting the nobleman time to escape. This was an easy decision, and a simple choice, given that Jenny had concluded she couldn't possibly fit into even a barrel-sized pipe. The second part of her plan was less thought out. She hoped to make it to the carriage shop across the street, in time to find shelter for herself. This latter part wasn't likely. Not by a long shot. So maybe this wasn't such a smart idea after all. The reality of her situation crystallized when her exhausted legs finally gave out. With muscles screaming from fatigue, Jenny stumbled on the uneven cobblestones. Then she fell face first in the street, as the giant statue of Novron closed in. Chapter 28 Hide and Seek. Royce followed a dirt path outside the ruin, looking for clues. He wasn't certain what he hoped to find. A dropped note penned by Vilar saying, "I went this way," would have been helpful. Hadrian eventually exited the ruins and circled them twice before wading into where the hawthorn bushes were thick. Royce had no idea where the Duchess was. Still in the cell, if she was smart. The alarm might have returned to the city, or gone deeper into the forest. Both plans had advantages and drawbacks. The city was downhill, but the terrain was mainly open. The forest was closer and offered cover. Which way did he go? Hadrian emerged from the brambles.
Find anything?
Nope, Royce replied. The two met back at the ruins. The search was extra credit, and it wouldn't result in any higher payment. Royce was only looking because Vilar had nearly killed him on not just one, but two occasions. He didn't like loose ends, and Royce made a point of not letting those that opposed him live. He scanned the domed building. Such an odd place. The roof was the most striking feature. 40 feet high and massive. Royce was no engineer, but he couldn't imagine that creating a dome out of stone was an easy task. The only other one he'd seen was on the top of Grom Gallimus, and he wasn't certain what that was made of. Looked like gold, but probably was just painted that color. This roof was assembled from solid, hand-cut rock. No mortar. Each stone precisely fashioned. What is this place? Too small for a cathedral, monastery, or church. Too elaborate for a house. It appeared to be a temple of some sort, like an overgrown chapel.
You want to give up, don't you?
Hadrian asked. Not giving up. We found Jenny Winter, even saved her life. I bet Gabriel will pay us extra for that. Job is done. Besides, Vilar could be anywhere.
Pretty good bet he went to Grom Gallimus,
Hadrian said, as the two entered the temple.
Vilar doesn't seem like the type to just give up.
Not our problem. We did... They both halted abruptly, only a few steps inside the ruined temple. The first thing Royce noticed was the smell. The interior had an awful odor akin to...
Smells like someone roasted a dog in here, Hadrian whispered.
The whisper said more than the words. Hadrian had come to the same conclusion Royce had. Royce took another step and peered into the cell. The room, the whole temple, was deserted. But if that was true, where's the Duchess? He whispered back.
I'm guessing on her way back to Rochelle,
Hadrian replied. He had one hand on the handle of his short sword as he carefully moved toward the fire. What had been a nearly extinguished pile of faintly smoking ash had come back to life. Flames continued to lick at a mostly consumed stack of wood. Royce glanced behind him at the doorway they had entered. He looked at the floor near the wall and found it bare. There was a box here, Royce said. I saw it when I came out of the cell. Hadrian nodded.
Like the one Griswold gave Erasmus. I think that's what's burning.
Royce stared at the fire. Vilar didn't run away.
He doubled back.
That's crazy. We were just outside looking for him.
That's a huge gamble.
All his stuff is here.
He had to come back.
He waited for us to leave, probably figured we would go back to Rochelle and look for him at the cathedral, just like you said. When we ran out, he rushed back in.
Not a bad idea, considering it's the one place we knew he couldn't be. Royce and Hadrian began a systematic search of the debris, but found nothing.
So, where is he now?
Jenny expected to be crushed. She thought the stone Novron would stomp her like a bag of grapes. But instead, the God Emperor's head cocked to one side, as if listening. Then it abruptly turned and charged east between the gallery and the cathedral. It didn't quite run.
Jenny wasn't certain something that big and heavy could, but the long legs gave it the speed of a horse. She watched it leave, dumbfounded.
Where's it going?
Genevieve?
The man she had pulled clear called out from the mouth of the drainpipe, looking like a groundhog peering out of its hole. Jenny rolled to one side. She wasn't getting up. That was way too much effort. Instead, she crawled over the cobblestones. She recognized the blood-smeared face of Armand Calder. Earl of some place. She didn't know him well. She'd only seen him once during her wedding. She seemed to recall he might have kissed her hand. He was a lesser lord, no one of great account in the world of Alban politics. "Hello, army. How are you doing?" she responded with a ridiculous smile. "Hanging in there, right? You're going to be fine. Might not be dancing for a while, but you'll be up and about in no time, trust me. I'm going to see to that." Armand shook his head. Either it was the pain, which looked considerable given the condition of his leg that had been facing the wrong way when she'd found him, or the terror had finally caught up. But she saw tears in the Earl of Someplace's eyes.
"It just came to life and started killing everyone. Everyone."
He shuddered as he spoke. "Everyone." The word hurt to hear. Yet hope, like a wisp of smoke in the temporary absence of a breeze, lingered.
"What about..."
Jenny stopped herself. She needed to know.
"Have you seen my... Leo wasn't here,"
Armand stated. Luckily, Jenny was already on her hands and knees. Even so, she nearly collapsed.
"Are you saying... I mean... are you sure?"
The news was too wonderful to accept. Jenny so desperately desired to believe Armand that her need made her hesitate.
"I'm only hearing what I want to hear. His spot, the chair next to Florette's, was empty all morning,"
the Earl told her.
"Are you sure?" Jenny replied. "We're talking about Leopold Hargrave, Duke of Rochelle."
"Yes,"
Armand nodded.
"Your husband."
"But Leo, he..."
"He never showed up," Armand said. "Guess he didn't want to be king as much as the rest of us. Lucky him."
Jenny's body was still begging for air from all her exertion, but at that moment she held her breath.
"Do you know where Leo is?"
"He was out looking for you. Everyone was talking about it."
Jenny breathed.
"Army,"
she said, crawling the rest of the way to the Earl of someplace.
"Army, you sweet, sweet man."
She helped pull him out of the cobblestones and covered him with a discarded cloak, tucking the edges around his neck.
"You hang on. I'm going to take care of you. I'm going to see you get through this. I swear by every god there is that I will."
She meant it. Every word. Jenny decided then and there that she would defend Armand Calder with the last beat of her heart, for he had given her a gift beyond value, beyond imagining, beyond her wildest dreams. Leo wasn't just alive. Leo loved her. They were beneath the dome in a generally round room, with the fire pit in the middle. The interior was a mess of overturned crates, urns, and scattered piles of wool, of which there was a surprising amount. Royce and Hadrian had dug through the clutter. Several tall clay pots stained with tears of blue dye. An overturned wooden tub. Mounds and mounds of raw wool. But no Vilar. Royce heard something outside. A distant thumping sound, like someone running. He darted out, certain that Vilar had broken from cover and was making a dash for it. But the sound was louder than the pounding of hooves. It sounded like...
"Royce?"
Hadrian poked his head out of the doorway and then joined him.
"Royce, what is that?"
Peering between the oak tree and a spruce, Royce saw the sun glint off something brilliantly white, something moving toward them at the speed of a galloping horse. As it cleared a gully, Royce got a good look.
"Royce, is that..."
"The statue of Novron from the plaza," Royce finished for him. They could both see it clearly as it travelled through the open, its long legs stomping with ease across the same fields and thickets they had just struggled up. The god's chest was marred. Chips of marble had been chiselled away. Other than that, he was perfect as only an artist could create. Broad shoulders, narrow hips, lean muscle. This was exactly how Royce expected Novran to look. Not surprising, given that Royce's understanding of the god had been formed by various statues like this that he'd seen in and around churches. This one had been the best of those, the most realistic. In many ways, too realistic. Seeing it move felt less strange than knowing the lifelike statue was only stone. As the statue grew nearer, Royce saw dark stains on its legs, as if the son of Maribor had been stomping grapes for wine.
"Don't suppose it's just out for a stroll, eh?"
Hadrian said, even as he drew his two swords.
"What are you going to do with those? It's stone. You'd do better with a hammer and chisel." "Don't have those."
The statue crashed through a copse of trees, kicking them into a cloud of splinters.
A branch, too heavy for Royce to lift, landed 20 feet away. Novron was close enough for him to see the marble god's expression. The normally stoic, proud, and noble features were twisted in vicious rage. Royce pulled Alverstone out from the folds of his clothes.
"Oh, okay," Hadrian said. "A dagger is so much better."
"A very sharp dagger," Royce replied. "When I was on Gromgallimus..."
"Gromgallimus! Sacred ground!" Hadrian burst out. "Get back inside!"
They ran through the doorway. Having fought the gargoyle, Royce knew all too well the impossibilities of combat with living stone. He had managed to do some tiny damage with Alverstone, but Hadrian was right. A dagger wasn't a match for a giant. The fall from the roof of Gromgallimus had destroyed the golem, but that wasn't going to happen this time. Novron the Great looked a whole lot more dangerous than the stone monkey with its useless wings. But the thought that they could hide inside the ruin and wait out the golem like a summer downpour felt like little more than wishful thinking.
"Not going to work," Roy said, as outside they heard and felt the rumble of the charging marble giant.
"Why do you say that?"
"The golems can't tread on sacred ground thing can't be true. I fought the gargoyle on top of Gromgallimus," Roy said, as if admitting some terrible sin.
He had to shout to be heard over the hammering of the statue's footfalls as it closed the remaining distance.
"Doesn't get much more holy than a cathedral."
Royce and Hadrian waited, each with a wincing expression. Nothing happened. The footfalls ceased. Through the open doorway, they spotted a pair of marble legs. They stood like a pair of birch trunks. Hadrian looked at Royce and smiled. Royce shrugged.
"Maybe because I was on the roof, it wasn't literally sacred ground. Or perhaps only the altar is sacred."
He didn't think the golem's restriction would be that specific, and yet he couldn't come up with any other reason why Vilar's Novron wasn't crawling through the door to kill them.
"It's not reaching in the doorway either," Hadrian said. "Just standing there. Maybe it can't enter the interior space?"
Royce bent down and peered out of the legs.
"We can't stay here forever, but I'm thinking the god of man might."
Giant Novron also bent down and peered in at them.
"Remember what Griswold said? There's a time limit. The person animating the golem can't keep the connection too long, or his soul will get stuck permanently, making the golem an immortal, indestructible terror."
Royce sighed.
"And anyone willing to stick around to roast a child's heart while we were outside searching for him is bound to be the type to go down with his ship, the HMS Revenge. So, waiting for Vilar to break the connection might not be such a good plan."
"Probably not. Good news is that the Duchess is safe."
"Yes," Royce said with a sour look. "By all means, let's thank Maribor for that."
"Why not thank Novran? He's literally right outside."
Royce frowned.
"If only..."
he started to say, then stopped, as if a new thought distracted him. "Vilar has to be on sacred ground to summon that thing, right?"
Hadrian nodded. "And if he leaves it, the golem would kill him."
"Theoretically."
So he must still be here.
The ruin wasn't a big place. There were no adjoining rooms except the cell, no cabinets or curtains to hide.